Hello, and welcome back to Slut PhD. This is your host, Julie Fennell, and today I am joined by my partner in sub Artifiction in the sunny state of California, and our topic today will be masculine submission. As always, this podcast is intended for adults in whatever area that you're listening from. So if you, like me, are in the United States, that means for people ages 18 and over, we will be talking about sex, sexuality, gender, explicit descriptions of sex and kink. For present, there are no trigger warnings for this episode. However, we're going to be picking up from where we left off in the previous episode, talking about gender and BDSM roles. We had ended by talking about some of the ways that self-esteem breaks out in BDSM roles when you look at the kink scene from my survey in 2017. And if you are trying to follow along from any of that, you can find it in my book, Please Scream Quietly, A Story of Kink. And you can see in there some of the charts for what I'm talking about. And I'll put more information about that in the notes for this episode. The thing that I really want to draw your attention to as we talk about masculine submission is that for this overlap of gender and BDSM role with scene involvement, there's this really grim number that shows up that the group with the lowest self-esteem is actually cis men bottoms who are tied with gender non-conforming people with penises as switches. Both of them have like really, really low self-esteem among people with high scene involvement. And they're also the only two groups that show decline. So for most groups of people, when you break it out by gender times BDSM role, you see that level of scene involvement tends to improve people's self-reported self-esteem. But that's not true for cis men bottoms, nor for these gender non-conforming people with penises who are switches. The switches, by the way, they are like the loaded category for that group, the larger category. And I think that it's really important to talk about why these groups aren't doing so great. And so I have brought in my partner to try to talk some more about the experiences of men who are submissive and what it is that they encounter both in and out of the BDSM scene. And hopefully he will provide some insight and clarification on that when I turn things over to him. I also want to draw your attention at the start of this to the fact that pop cultural portrayals of masculine submission are scarce. They typically involve men paying professional dominatrixes rather than engaging in relationships, which, as far as I can tell from my numbers, isn't very far off the mark. It looks like from my survey that a good chunk of the male submissives with female dominance kink that's occurring outside of the context of the BDSM scene is often happening in a financial arrangement. That is to say, usually the male subs are paying the female doms. I don't have any insight to offer on male subs with male doms, partly because the world of gay men's BDSM is quite different in general, and also I have never studied it, but hopefully someone might pop in with some of their own stories for that down in the comments. If you're looking for major pop cultural portrayals of male submission outside, I mean, actually I can't think of any in a gay male context either, but the major one is in the TV show Billions. I've actually written a little bit about this on a paper that I wrote on feminine domination. I was left in the weird position researching that paper of jumping through this TV show that I mostly hadn't watched and just watching all of the sex scenes so that I could analyze them, which was fascinating and weird. But the two of the characters at the core of the show, Chuck and Maggie, they're married and they have a bedroom only DS arrangement where she is the dom and he is the sub. The show writers say that they hired professional dominatrixes to advise them. They definitely seem to have been reasonably thoughtful in the ways that they constructed that. But it is also telling, I think, that in interviews, the actress who played Maggie has stated that she felt like the character was really only doing it because that was what her husband wanted, rather than being motivated by what, you know, her character wanted. And again, I think that that is not far off the mark from what tends to happen a lot outside of the BDSM scene, especially where, like, a lot of times it seems like male subs outnumber female doms, and like women are just sort of going along with it because it's what the men want. More recently, I was particularly struck by the portrayal of Rand and Lanfear's relationship in season 2 of Wheel of Time, which to me actually felt more real in the sense of like, that's more what my own experience, at least, of these types of relationships has been, minus, you know, demons and like non-consensuality. But like the underlying desires going on there at least felt more real to me, and also a certain degree of tension in that both the characters seem a little bit switchier than what shows up between Chuck and Maggie. So if you're looking for like, hey, where could I go see some of this in a TV show? Those are just a couple of places to run to, and also like wildly contrasting portrayals of what these types of dynamics could look like in real life. But I'm mostly going to turn things over for now to Art of Fiction and spend much of the rest of this podcast interviewing him about his experiences. And we've obviously had a lot of conversations about this over time. He is actually instrumental in helping me construct the class that I've taught in many, many places on femdom many years ago before we'd ever started dating. Then we ran into each other again, and then we started to construct a DS arrangement ourselves. So we've had a lot of time to talk about gender and kink and stuff. And one of the things that he said as we were talking about doing this podcast episode together was that he felt like he was a bad ambassador for male subs. So you want to talk a little bit about why you feel like you're a bad ambassador for male subs?
Sure. Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Art of Fiction. I'm Julie's sub and partner. Yeah. So I think that part of the problem is that whenever we're talking about something like this, right, there's the idea of who are the real male submissives. And especially because such a core part of the cultural depiction of what male submission looks like is like, you know, your generic femdom, like professional dom with a client, you know, latex corsets and whips and chains, high heels, all that jazz, right? Like there's the costume, there's the client, and like that's the most common depiction. And if in fact that is the most common depiction, who am I to say that that's not really what male submission is? On the other hand, as someone who does identify as a male submissive and really finds that that particular portrayal doesn't really line up with what I see submission as being, I feel like inherently, if I'm going to be talking about male submission, I'm going to be talking from a place of being like, well, this is what true male submission is. and I don't know that I have the authority to say that. And also, like, I clearly won't be speaking for the majority of the population. But I guess from some point of view, my perspective is that it's not actually the same population, right? Like that maybe I'm a decent ambassador for the set of people that I consider true male submissives. Maybe not, but certainly I'm not necessarily a good ambassador for people who are, you know, primarily clients of pro-doms, being that I've never been the client of a pro-dom.
I think the thing to look out for in that distinction a lot of times between like these true submissives, right, is the kink community has a bad habit of drawing these lines between like real dominance and like fake dominance and real submissives and fake submissives. And nothing is ever that clear cut for sure. But one of the things that I think plagues a lot of the relationships between femtops and masculine submissives in the BDSM scene and outside of it is that men who are fetishists are told by the larger culture that they're submissive. So like, oh, you have a foot fetish, you must be a sub. Now you should go pay somebody to do this foot thing for you. And the reality is that having a fetish might make you submissive or it might not. There's not really much of a connection there, but research strongly suggests that having a true fetish, something that you need in order to achieve a full sense of sexual satisfaction, is mostly or possibly exclusively connected to testosterone. And so this is something that you find much more among men than among women. And by much more, I mean, I'm not sure that I've ever personally met a woman who has what would be considered one of those classical definitions of a fetish, but I met plenty of men who did. But the reality is that having a fetish doesn't make you a sub. It doesn't make you a dom. It doesn't make you anything other than a fetishist. But the culture is like, hey, people with fetishes, you should go pay somebody to do that thing for you, because where are you ever going to find someone who does it to you for fun? And I think a lot of that ends up creating tensions among people like Art of Fiction who identify as a submissive, meaning, well, maybe I should let you say, what is it to you that makes you feel like you're like in this camp of true submissives?
Well, first of all, I would say that I don't necessarily truly identify as like being a true submissive. I was kind of using that tongue in cheek to describe the difference. But I mean, I think that the fundamental difference for me is that the question for me in domination and submission is whose desire is being served, whose will is being served, right? And of course, if it's a good partnership, both people's desires are being fulfilled, right? But there's the question of like, who sets the direction? To use a common analogy that I've often used in dance or in song, you know, in dance, who is the lead, who is the follow? In song, who is the call, who is the response? And of course, there is an aspect of partnership to dance where, you know, the follow is contributing and the follow is in some ways choosing parts of the direction of the dance, but the lead is initiating, the lead is driving. It is the lead's vision of what the dance should look like that determines what the dance is. And if we're looking at things from that point of view, what is the locus of desire, then the conventional depiction of femdom, both in femdom porn and in a prodom context, the desire being served is the desire of the male quote-unquote submissive, right? Like, there is a person who is coming into this with a specific set of desires. In pornography, it's either the person who's watching the porn, which is typically men, mainly watch femdom porn, and the directors, etc., also frequently men. And in the case of the prodom, it's the client, right? It is very much a service profession, right? Like, there is a person coming in with a desire, and there is someone who is there to fulfill the desire, and then that arrangement is compensated using money. I think it's very hard to map the prodom client relationship as one being driven by the desire of the prodom.
But that's not what you want, right?
Sure, like, yeah.
Yeah, you're looking for the one where you get to be a follow because it's what somebody wants.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, if I'm looking at true submission from the point of view of whose desire is served, who has the power, who wields the power, that's, to me, what submission is. Submission is to seek out power, to seek out will, and then submit yourself to it.
So could you tell your own story then about how you got involved in kink? So like fantasies that drew you when you were younger, or things that you learned about the scene and the things that you were looking for when you got to it?
Sure. It's always tricky to talk about because we as a culture really like to pretend that people don't exist as sexual or even somewhat sexual beings until they become adults. But
that's,
you know,
bullshit.
Yeah. But in practice, that is how we often treat it. I think that from my perspective, like, I knew that the way that I lean in general is towards being a follow, towards submission for most of my life. The joke that I always tell about what is the origin for me of submissiveness, or like, how did I know? I tell this story about when I was a kid, the first time I watched Sleeping Beauty, someone actually had to explain to me why exactly Prince Philip, after getting kidnapped and captured by Maleficent and thrown in a dungeon, breaks out and leaves. Because my 7 or 8 year old self watching this thought it was really quite rude. Clearly she went to a lot of bother to get him there, and maybe she had reasons for wanting him to be there, and it felt disrespectful for him to, you know, not honor all that effort. And I think that the fact that somebody had to explain to me, oh, well, yeah, you know, he's breaking out because this was done against his will and she's the bad guy, etc., was, if not a formative moment, at least a memory that tells me that, you know, from a very early age, I was already inclined in this direction. And I mean, from there, you know, I was a teenager in the early 2000s, so access to the internet in all of its uncensored glory was relatively easy to get. I probably ran into out and out, oh, this is what kink looks like content when I was like 12 or 13 for the first time, if not younger than that. And I think like over the next, I don't know, 5, 6, however many years, I, you know, discovered online communities that talked about BDSM and kink. And by the time I turned 18, I knew what FetLife was. I knew where you would go to find a social space. I had picked out what was the first kink social event, what munch I was going to go for the first time when I turned 18. I think within a week of my 18th birthday, I went to that event. Like, the knowledge that that's my inclination has been with me for most of my life, certainly all of my remembered life, and figuring out what shape that was going to take, you know, responded to what the shape of what was available. What are my natural inclinations? What is available in terms of partnerships, in terms of communities? Like, the language that we have available in a lot of ways can actually limit what we can identify being. As we develop new terms, more people can use those terms to define themselves, and that can be both limiting and expansive. Various cultures have different definitions of gender roles and of alternative gender roles, and therefore express gender in different ways. And the expressions of gender roles that we have now affect how people might present themselves. And likewise, I think, unfortunately, the language that's available and the communities that are available can shape what that initial inclination turns into, right?
So when you arrived, you showed up so young. Like, what were you hoping to find? Like, I want a dom? Or what were you looking for when you showed up at these munches when you're 18?
I mean, I was 18, so probably to some extent I was looking for, you know, a relationship. Certainly, I wanted a dom. Having had, you know, I flirted with people who also, like me, had explored kink online and found that that was part of their identity. And I wanted to build a relationship with someone for whom that was more than just, you know, a casual curiosity. I think also a big part of it was just wanting to find community. I had experienced kink community online, and that certainly has a certain shape to it. But the desire to get to spend time around people, to get to talk to other people about what my experiences were, about what these thoughts were. I still remember, like, pretty early on, getting a ride from a friend who I had developed in the kink community to some event or another with, like, two other kinky people in the car, and just having that experience of four people in one car talking about kink like it was just any other conversational topic, and that making me feel very, like, very free in a way, where instead of constantly having to go around with some significant part of myself always hidden, always chopped off, that part of me could be free. I could be more of myself in that space than I could be anywhere else.
How well accepted did you feel as a masculine sub, and how easy was it for you to find a dom?
You know, that's a hard question. I think that at the time I was not necessarily a pretty shy person, because I've never been especially shy, but I was not necessarily a very pushy person. And as per a follows perspective, I was stepping out on the dance floor and trying to see what I would find and what might come to me. I probably didn't even go to, like, a real play party for a year or two, because, like, I just felt more comfortable going to the social events. Also, there was probably some amount of the parties that didn't let people in under 21. In terms of finding a dom, I don't think I found a dom anywhere close to immediately. Once I started going to play parties, I definitely had more opportunities to play with people who were interested in topping or willing to top. But, like, certainly for me now, and to some extent for me back then, there was a distinction for me between topping and doming. I don't think that I had much luck finding a dom early on. And I think part of the problem there was that my inclination as a sub was not to chase people, because if my core conceptualization of what it means to be a sub is to serve the desires of somebody else, trying to find somebody whose desires I want to serve ends up feeling a little bit, if not necessarily hypocritical, but kind of self-defeating, right? Like, if I am the person who finds them, then clearly they are the person who is serving my desires, because I did the hunting. I think that that was a pretty limiting perspective to have in practice. And certainly I think that limited my opportunities at the time.
Did you feel accepted as a masculine sub in those initial, like, forays into the scene?
Well, the nice thing about existing in a space passively is that you don't experience very much rejection. Right. The fact that I was just around, right? I come to a play party, I don't necessarily expect to find play. I don't necessarily expect to find a dom, and I don't ask anybody to scene with me. I just kind of hang out and see what happens. Passively, it's very easy to find acceptance, because you're not trying to ask for anything or get anything that goes against the norm. It was very easy to exist in the background in a very undemanding way and to feel accepted. But, like, the question is, like, to feel accepted as what, right? Like, to feel accepted as a neutral person who happens to exist in the space? Yeah, absolutely. I totally felt accepted as that. The people were friendly. And I mean, I think in general, kink groups and kinky people tend to be, like, On the friendly side, they were also all a bunch of weirdos, just like I was, and like the overlap in terms of interest between like, kinky people and nerds is pretty high. So it was easy to find people who I felt were similar to me and who I could click with socially, even for reasons other than kink. It just so happened that we could also talk about kink.
Makes sense. You have talked a lot about how being a submissive man often leaves you feeling like something is fundamentally wrong with you or about you. Can you elaborate more about what that means for you and what that experience has been?
Yeah, I mean, that's a heavy subject, but I think that it's about feeling like there's a fundamental misalignment between how I exist in the world and what the world would most want from me. Misalignment between my calling and what the world needs. And what I mean by that is that on average, when I'm in a space, when I'm in a kinky space, to what extent do I feel like the thing that is desired in that space is the presence of a male submissive? If I talk to 10 people in that space, what percentage of them are going to find me more desirable or find my presence there more desirable if I'm a male dom rather than a male sub? I think on average, I would certainly find that people would rather that I was a dom. The quintessential example of this would be like, let's say I'm using a kinky dating app, which fortunately we live in a day and age where you can have a dating app for kinky people. And you're swiping through and you just see submissive people, submissive people, submissive people, submissive people. Or you chat with someone that you're attracted to at a party and like you talk about inclinations and they're submissive. And you're like, oh, great. Like, if I was approaching this from the point of view of like of a dominant person, I would be more desired, right? I would fit in more. And certainly if I'm looking for any kind of play or intimacy in a kinky space, if I approach it from the point of view of being a sub-leaning switch who is very willing to top, it's very easy for me to find play and to find connection. And if I'm not willing to do that, if I'm not willing to compromise on being submissive, it's a lot harder to find that. And when you constantly run into situations like that where you're like, oh, cool, like if I want to experience intimacy in this space or intimacy in this community, the easiest thing for me to be is a male dom, you feel really misaligned with fundamentally reality in a way, right?
Yeah. I find it fascinating, though, how much I wonder the degree to which this is based on perception, right? Because when I look at my numbers, and these numbers are available on my FetLife under IP Cookie Monster, there's a graph which I'll also try to repost to my blog, SlutPhD, as well. And it in it, I'm talking about who like benefits from scene involvement. And one of the things that I found in my survey in 2017 that I found really interesting is that if you break it out by levels of scene involvement, gender, and BDSM role, the levels of play and sex for male subs actually look very similar to for female subs. If you're comparing male subs to male tops, though, that's like half as much, right? But the same is true for female subs and female tops. But of course, the proportions are so different for those. And so who you end up comparing yourself to is really different. And also, there's just a general, it's clear in my survey that at least conceptually, everyone says in the scene, pansexual scene, says they think women are hotter. Even straight women seems to think women are hotter than men. But it's interesting how much I think male subs end up feeling like that, in spite of the fact that their real world experiences look a lot like those of female subs in terms of how many people they've played with recently and how many people they've had sex with recently. But they look so different from male tops, and they're surrounded by male tops. That's like the thing that they usually see. And on top of that, I think also is just in general the rejection. It's not even a bias, but the experience of as a man, being the person who's expected to make the first move. And so somebody says no to you a lot more. Whereas if you're a woman, people are coming to you and you're the one who's either saying yes or no. So the sense of constantly being rejected, I think, is very different in that context as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's what I would say is that when you look at the outcomes and say, oh, well, look, male subs get as much play as female subs, I would say, well, sure, maybe, but what is the effort that needs to get put in
Yeah.
order to get that outcome? If I'm a female sub and I come to a dungeon or to a play party, what is the chance that I'm going to be proactively propositioned for a scene versus if I'm a male sub and I come to a play party? And of course, I'm not going to pretend that that's all roses and that my experience of female subs is easier in some ways. Certainly, the problem with experiencing life as an object of desire means you can't escape that and you end up with like lots of predatory behavior and all that. But from the point of view of actually experiencing proactive desire, certainly I think that female subs probably have an easier time of finding that. And that means that when I am looking for play, yeah, I can absolutely find it. But let's say that as a sub, I need to talk to like, you know, 10 people in order to find someone who might be interested in domming or topping, and the other 9 people I talk to want to be subs as well, I'm going to feel like I'm misaligned with 9/10 of the room, which can feel pretty isolating. And certainly it can feel fundamentally like, well, I'm always paddling upstream, right? Like, in order to get what I want, I have to fight for it. And it's not that I'm unwilling to fight for it, it's that fighting for it gets exhausted.
Yeah, I think it's a really great metaphor there to imagine that one was a gay man. Imagine a world where there's no gay clubs, right? And so you just have to go into the world where a very small percentage of people are interested in having sex with you, and you keep going up to man after man. And sure, when you find the other gay man, there's a pretty decent chance he's going to have sex with you. You have to undergo a lot of rejection before you finally find the person who says yes. And yes, there are like mingling events, there's socials in the scene that are focused on like femdoms and mask subs together, but they're usually very well attended, unfortunately. If you look at the numbers, there's just not a ton of people who are into this. And increasingly, to further muddy the waters, it switches with switches. And so whenever I teach femdom these days, usually most of the people in the room, it's like plenty of interested femtops show up, plenty of interested mask subs show up, and sometimes some fem subs show up as well, who are curious about, you know, having femtops. But like when I teach this stuff at pansexual kink events, I find increasingly that like the room is full of switches, and that really changes the opportunity structure of who's doing what when that happens. And then on top of that, you have this layered gendered expectation that men are still doing more of the asking. And also in the scene in general, there's an expectation that bottoms are doing more of the asking. So you've like doubled up this asking burden on top of things as well, I think, as a mask sub.
Is that true for female subs finding scenes at a play party, that female subs do more of the asking?
Absolutely. I checked on Instagram because I was curious as I was coming back into the rope scene having to tie. And I mean, I can't speak to the general population of BDSM, but I think it's more exaggerated in rope world, but not far. And I was like, if your most new tie that you did with somebody who initiated at the rigger or the bottom, and 75% of people said the bottom.
Well, I would say that rope is a very different community.
Different, but I think that there's still an underlying expectation that bottoms approach tops. And lots of people, like myself, who are very experienced tops, actually, by the point you reach very experienced, really discouraged by seeing norms for approaching people, because then you seem predatory. So like there's actually a fair bit of social pressure on you to not approach people, and you end up doing kind of a reverse, what I always call the handkerchief dance, where like you drop a handkerchief so that somebody will pick it up, and then now, you know, that's the way you can like say, we're flirting now. Like, have to learn to do this bizarre dance as a top of like sort of flirting with somebody but letting them come to you. Which fortunately comes pretty naturally to me, I think, but is not something that a lot of people know how to do instinctively. And so, yeah, there's like a weird dance at the mid-level of experience. I think that's less true, because there's a lot of weird complications there that come with like very experienced tops versus like mid-range experienced tops. As a mid-range experienced top, you have to do all the asking typically. So especially, again, in rope world, it's most visible, where when you're just learning how to tie, you're just like, have to ask everyone. You're like, please, I'm not very good. Will you suffer through my shitty rope? Yeah, I think it pervades a lot of the scene, of this expectation that like bottoms do more of the asking. But it definitely gets worse when you layer gender on top of it.
Yeah, I really do wonder to what extent that would still be true if instead of talking about rope, we're talking about like a general play party. Maybe I should ask some friends and find out.
Yeah, we can do polls on FetLife now. We can
Let's do
ask.
some polls on
Could do
FetLife.
some polls on FetLife and post the numbers under this. So, can you talk about who taught you how to be a sub? Like, what was your experience of like going to classes or socialization? More generally, like, who were your role models and the kind of social support that you've received in terms of becoming a sub?
Yeah, I was lucky in a lot of ways. I started my kink experiences in Pittsburgh on the East Coast. And at the time, there was someone there who was literally running a welcome munch for new kinksters. And one of the people who was running that was Rue, who I think is Ruru on FetLife. And the fact that one of the people who was running the welcoming event was a male submissive, I think that was lovely for me from the point of view of like feeling like, oh yeah, this is an acceptable thing to be there. And as far as I know, he's still in the scene. So yeah, like kudos to him and kudos to him for setting that as a model. I do think that he and I tend to do kink in very different ways. So I wouldn't necessarily say that he was a model for me in that way. I think that I take my role models much more from fictional spaces than I do from real people, because there's not, as you said, there's not a ton of great models of like overt BDSM male submission in popular media, but there is lots of like covert ones, right? The thing that I think complicates it or makes it challenging is that, and I could definitely do a whole podcast about this. But traditionally in media, for coming at kink from the point of view of whose desire is served as being the indicator of domination, like as my fairy tales professor would point out, one of the primary morals of many early fairy tales is that if a woman wants something, she's probably the villain, right? Like women are intended to be the passive recipients, and when a woman is pursuing something, she's probably evil. And I think would love to pretend that we've gotten further away from that. And certainly more recent Disney princesses are less inclined to be the passive recipient of male pursuit, like Go Mulan, love you, girl. But definitely in fiction, if you have in TV shows, etc., if you have a woman who's really going after a goal, who has a primary thing that she's chasing, pretty often that's gonna be the bad guy. Like the strong-willed character is going to be the bad guy if it's a woman. But if you do have that type of character and they have a loyal sidekick, then that can be a model to draw something from. Like, I think that, what's her name? Emperor's New Groove, Yzma and Kronk. Kronk is this lovely, lovable, competent, intelligent, hunky guy, very masculine, and exists very, very much to serve the desires and needs of a woman. And I wouldn't necessarily want to model a dom off of Yzma, but I could certainly see myself modeling myself off of Kronk. I think more so I would tend to draw it from written mediums. A big influence on me was Tamara Pierce's YA fantasy series, which had female protagonists, and those female protagonists often had male sidekicks, and those male sidekicks, were loyal, were dedicated, were not necessarily the focus of the story, but they were, depicted as good people, and their loyalty and etc. were depicted as positive qualities. And I think that I drew a lot of inspiration from that. The idea that submission really can come from a place of deep admiration for the person to whom you submit. Submission is a service that you provide, and submission is valuable.
Did you get much formal training? Like, were you able to go to classes, or did anyone take you on under their wing, really? Or is it mostly just a matter of like stumbling through?
I think it was mostly stumbling through, but I think that it's really hard to teach a class on submission itself. I think if you're not a submissive, you can't be taught to be one. And if you are a submissive, then the thing that is most important is for you to explore what that means to you rather than be taught something about it. I've always felt that the trappings of kink, how do you do impact, how do you do rope, all of these things. I mean, it's great. They're very interesting accessories to have, but they are accessories, right? Like, they aren't the main thing. The dynamic, the relationship is the main thing. So yeah, I don't necessarily know that there were a ton of classes that I learned from, but there were, series of relationships, series of connections where I would approach it from the point of view of a submissive. My connection would hopefully approach it from the point of view of a dominant, and that helped me evolve and understand what I wanted out of a partner, like what I wanted to have in a dom, which has made it easier to pursue that type of connection.
So I have a question down here, which I think we've danced around a lot during this conversation, which is us speculating, why do we think social support for masculine subs is so bad, both in and out of the scene? I'll let you start with your own thoughts on that.
Sure. I mean, I think a big part of it is gender roles. Another big part of it is, like I said, that the concept of these types of dynamics is really warped by the existence of male gaze driven femdom porn, male gaze driven femdom as a genre. That makes it certainly sometimes less appealing to identify as a male sub. If you create an event where you want to spend time with other male subs, talk about your experiences, inevitably you're also going to draw people who are coming at it from a very different perspective than you are, who are coming at it from the perspective of trying to find somebody who will do them the service of, you know, stepping on them or whatever, and that they're the person who's intending to get something out of that, which is a very different model of what it means to be a submissive. Like, I think it's a slightly strange model to have your model of being a submissive be, I go to this person and then I pay them to do the thing that I want for me. I wouldn't necessarily define that as submissive, but I think that's a component.
I actually don't know that I even have anything else to add to that other than the general observation that men are, especially, well, straight men at least, are really bad at being friends in our society in general, right? And so I think there's a huge gender, like larger scale gender force there that really impedes casual friendly socialization among masculine subs of like, oh, how do we support one another in a context where we've mostly never even learned how to be intimate and friendly with one another outside of this context? And then possibly layered on top of that, maybe, is because there's this perpetual sense of scarcity of available tops. There's like, oh, these people are all competition, which incidentally, I say this in the previous episode as well, but like the scarcity of tops is a little bit untrue, right? Like by the time you get to high levels of scene involvement, femme tops are double the number of mask subs, but somewhat to do with like possibly mask sub attrition and somewhat to do with like male subs turning into switches. But regardless, like there's a degree to which that perception is untrue once you're in the scene. Outside of the scene, it's absolutely true. But I think that sense from outside the scene pervades even once you're in. And I think that probably also contributes to a lack of cohesive socialization.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you're absolutely right that it creates a sense of competition. I personally don't tend to really feel a strong sense of that, in the sense of like, I don't feel like I am going to get more play if there are fewer male submissives around. I've always felt like the best way to get more play is to work on yourself and become the type of person that other people want. If you're looking at the population of femme dominant folks, it doesn't matter how many male submissives there are if none of them are matching what those people are looking for. So the thing that matters is being able to give the people that you want to serve what they're looking for in service. And that, I think, involves a lot more internal work. But even if there isn't like a direct sense of competition, there certainly isn't a sense that there's a ton to be learned from or to feel in community about with other male subs. I think that, especially because, like, as you noted, higher scene level involvement leads to lower self-esteem among male subs, is that a group of male subs chatting together about their shared experiences is a very depressing space to be in. Sure, we could say like, oh, well, let's have it be a support group for male subs. Well, if I have to choose between my weekly activity being a support group for male subs or going to a kink event and like hanging out with people and having fun and not having to talk about the inherently challenging experience of being a male sub, I'm probably going to choose the fun social space rather than the depressing one.
Makes sense. So my last question for you is, what advice would you give to young cis men starting out in the scene who want to be subs?
I mean, I think the first one really is the question of identify what being a sub means to you. Because for all that I joke about the whole idea of like, this is what true submissives are, this is what not true submissives are. If the thing that you want is for a person in a corset to specifically step on you, or specifically you want to lick her toes or whatever, like, that's absolutely a thing that I believe that you should have and get to enjoy. If that's something that you want to approach from the point of view of this is a service that I want to pay for, then that very much might be the right path for you. And I wouldn't discourage anybody from following that path if that's what they really want. I would much rather people be happy than that people be like me, right? But if you're looking at this from the point of view of like, no, I think that to me, submission means something along the lines of I want to find somebody whose desire I want to serve, right? Like I want to connect with someone in that way. I'd say that the biggest thing really is work on yourself. Find ways to become the type of person that other people are drawn to and interested. Figure out what you can offer in a connection. You should be a good listener. You should be a good conversationalist. Those things are huge. If you're good at physical touch, if you can give genuinely good physical touch, that's a great skill to have. I've certainly found that, like, the fact that as purely a platonic skill, I can do good massage. That is a very valuable skill to offer people. And even if you're not necessarily using it to like get play or whatever, that builds up your ability to read other people's bodies and that kind of thing. I think that that's a very useful thing to do. Also, when you are in play context, the biggest thing is don't forget that in practice, you are going to have to be the person who asks. I 100% get it that, like, man, I wish that it was the experience of being pursued. That's what I want. That's what I think the submissive dream is. But if you want to live in that dream, you're going to end up, I think, often disappointed. And on the other hand, if you're willing to do that, do the pursuit, do the job of finding the person who wants to play with you. Like that really is going to be on you, and it's important to build up the ability to fail and be rejected and then try again, right? I think that that's a huge thing, is like learning that you do have to often be the person who makes the first move. Learn how to do that in a way that is polite, in a way that is respectful, in a way that doesn't put people off. If every single time you talk to someone, you get a pretty aggressive pushback or brush off, maybe take a look at your approach rather than assuming that the person is rude. As with anything else in life, as with any other type of connection, it's more about what you bring to the connection and what you can do to make that connection work than what the other person can do for you. And especially for like a submissive, I think that should be the first question. If your first question when you step up to a dom is, hey, will you do X for me? I think you've asked a fundamentally non-submissive question and you're approaching it from a non-submissive place. I think the submissive question is, what can I do for you? I definitely think it's really important to know who you are, know what you are, know what buttons you have and what presses them, and to be able to offer this information to someone. Certainly coming into a kink negotiation with someone with, oh, I'll do whatever you want, is first of all probably not true, and second of all just not useful. 90% of the world's biodiversity happens in places where two different ecosystems overlap, and likewise 90% of the world's interesting kink scenes happen in the intersection between two people's desires. You should know what you want, and you should be willing to offer that information to the other person, not with the expectation that they're going to fulfill it, but so that they know how to use that. You have to label all your buttons so they know that how to play with them.
So when it comes to pro-doming, I think Artifiction and I both have some like complicated and nuanced feelings of this. Both having, I hasten to add, never really done this much. Like I have been paid to do rope a couple of times, but for only for photography. And you said you've never paid anyone. And so we come at this from the perspective of people who like this is our relationship choice primarily. Although in my case, certainly I've never nixed the option that I might start doing pro-doming if I needed the money. Mostly it's just for me an issue of if you get paid to do what you love, then will you keep loving it? And it's a tricky question for sure. We both were talking, you have a lot of fairly complicated thoughts on that. So what were some of yours that you wanted to share?
Well, yeah, I just want to say that, I have played with pro doms. I've just never paid to play with pro
Yeah.
doms. I've played with pro doms in either a social context, or I've gone on a date with somebody who also in the professional life works as a pro dom, and we've played in that context. And I in no way think that pro doms aren't noms, right?
Yeah.
Many of the friends that I have that are pro doms are doms in their social life as well. And just because you're going to a pro dom doesn't mean you aren't a true submissive. I think it's more that specifically the fact that to some extent, especially for femdom porn, even more than pro doms, it is shaped by male desire. The lens on it is male desire. The perspective on it is male desire. And the thing that is being served is male desire, I feel like can distract from a very important aspect of what it means to be a submissive. And I think that really does originate in when you're coming to someone as a submissive, what is the question you're asking? And if the question you're asking is, will you do X for me? That's not a submissive question.
Yeah, also there's a sociological book on dominatrixes called Dominatrix by Daniel Lindemann. It's fairly old now, but I definitely talk some about also the way that prodoms themselves draw some really interesting distinctions between what they think of as real prodoms versus not. And they have a lot of at least in the New York prodoms that she was studying at the time. In the early 2000s, had some pretty severe lines for themselves that they drew upon on that. Certainly, my own experience, I would say the majority of prodoms that I've encountered in the BDSM scene usually tend to identify more as submissives than they do as dominants. But a lot of the people in Daniel Lindemann's book were lifestyle dominants as well as being prodoms. So there's plenty of overlap between those things. It just can be hard sometimes, I think, if you are used to doing things because it's what you want to do, and now you have to really be shaped by what a client wants from you. And I can imagine how much any type of arrangement, money tends to get in the way a lot of times of the way that we relate to one another. And if that's the context that you came from and then you move to. It is really interesting when I've talked to prodoms too about how they're selective about which clients they will recommend to join the scene. And so they're very careful, they tell me, about the types of people who they recommend to join the scene. And I've never understood exactly what the rules are for that, but I did interview several for my book, and they told me that they're very careful about the types of people that they recommend. And it's further complicated if you're talking about the pansexual BDSM scene by the fact that prodoms have had a really strong impact on certain geographical micro scenes, basically, which aren't micro scenes at all. But at least when I was studying the scene in 2012, which was obviously a very long time ago, prodoms had a huge impact and presence in the New York City scene and also in the Philadelphia scene. And had basically no presence whatsoever in the DC scene, which was where I was and am based. And the contrast between those was quite stark at the time. I believe that's no longer true in the New York scene and possibly in the Philly scene as well. But it really has a different shape when you're pulling in a lot. There were a lot more male subs showing up at the parties in New York and Philly than there were in DC, which was really interesting to me as a woman coming looking mostly to top at the time. Like, oh wow, this is a different demography.
Yeah, and I just want to say that it was it's really important to me that I be clear that I'm not anti-pro dom. I would say I'm very pro-pro dom, right? I really think that people should be able to get paid for what they love to do if that's the way that they want to do it. I also think that money is a type of power, and who is spending the money, who is receiving the money, is also a type of power exchange. And I think it's important to be conscious of that when we're talking about what it means to be submissive.
That's wonderful advice. And thank you so much for sharing your insights from your experience. Thank you all for listening. If you keep listening in a couple of weeks, hopefully I will be able to post some episodes complementing this one when I will interview my co-top, who is also a femdom about our experiences as femdoms. If you want to support me and my work, please go and check out my book, Please Scream Quietly, A Story of Kink, which is a sociological study of the BDSM scene published in 2022. Some of the numbers that I was mentioning today are in there. And also more recently, I published a book called Violated, Sexual Consent and Assault in the 21st Century. Both of those books are available pretty much anywhere where you would look for books. And thank you for listening.
And if you want to find me, I'm Artifiction on FetLife. That's like artifact, but fiction, Artifiction. And feel free to send me a message about how wrong I am about what being a true male submissive is. I reserve the right to have fully changed my mind 2 years from now. I think that that's about the expiration date on coherent opinions about what kink means.
It's true. I think you definitely changed opinions on some things in the time that we've been together, and that's been 2 years. So may yet be more. Thank you all for listening. Mm-hmm.